Well, thanks, Jörn. I assume my mic is on at some point. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
I can't see you. It's like stage lights. Okay. One of the nice things about the program part of the astroseismology issues here at KITP is we're all kind of experts. We all kind of know sufficient amounts about stars, stellar structure, and astroseismology that our couple of times a week seminars don't have introductions. We just cut right to the chase and save a lot of time for discussion. I'm going to almost do the same thing here, but not quite, and spend the next half hour or 20 minutes at least giving you an introduction to how we learn about physics, or how we might learn about basic physics from astroseismology. I won't be talking about astroseismology in detail, just highlighting some results and pointing out some issues that astroseismology can address. And it's up to the rest of you over the course of this week, modulo people escaping to the sunshine when the sun does shine. It's up to you guys to sort of fill in some of the gaps with successes that we've had and also successes that we might anticipate in the future. So, there we go. First of all, I need to briefly review stellar structure and give you a reminder of the basic equations of stellar structure and where the physics basically comes in. If you want more details, there's an excellent book still on the market.
There are also some lecture notes that are free.
There are lecture notes that are free, but not nearly as good. You get what you pay for. And each comment from Jörn adds a minute to my time. Anyhow, remember that stellar structure, as we understand it, is very different from the structure of stars. We understand it based on very simple modeling, spherically symmetric, one-dimensional-ish objects. We pick an independent variable, either the radius or the mass fraction contained within that radius, and then we calculate things as a function of that independent variable from the center of our structure to the surface. We can't do it everywhere, so we pick discrete shells, and we make believe we know what's going on in between with some sort of interpolation scheme. We're making several assumptions right off the bat that are invalid at some level, and certainly at the level of precision with which we can make measurements in astroseismology, almost all of these assumptions can be tossed out the window. Basically, we're considering a star as a spherical cow. There he is, spherical cow. There's also a spherical monkey, spherical toucan, and a spherical mosquito, which hopefully we won't encounter during this visit. Given that independent variable and a set of equations, we want to know lots of other things at those positions. One of the things we don't want to know, or we would love to know but can't deal with, is velocity. So we set the velocity equal to zero everywhere. We end up with something that we call an equilibrium structure. And we describe that with any number of various parameters, density, pressure, temperature, internal energy, entropy, ion and charge balance, depending on your composition as a function of position, et cetera, et cetera. We also would like to know something about the heat flow. And to do that, we need to know something about how heat flows. So we need parameters that describe diffusion of heat through radiation, conduction. We need to know about advective transport of heat, motions, and how that affects the structure of our fake star. All of these things would be nice to know for eventual application to understanding observations. The way we look at these parameters, there's sort of the core four. Baseball fans will recognize them. We have our independent variable, radius or mass. Our dependent variables, if we have four equations, that means four dependent variables. We've got P, we've got T, we've got L sub R. From those, we also need some other things. We need to know the composition as a function of depth within our stars, or within our models anyway. There are quantities we need to solve these equations, to figure these things out. We need equation of state parameters. We need the density, the composition. We need some measure of energy and entropy. We need some sort of gradients to describe heat flow, and so on. That all comes through the equation of state. Then there's atomic physics that we need to calculate some of those parameters more precisely. We need some nuclear physics to figure out how efficient a furnace these stars are. And then there's confusing physics that we need to know as well, the convective flux, the amount of energy transported by bulk motions, and so on. That's just to calculate structure. If we want to calculate oscillation frequencies, or heaven forbid, growth rates or amplitudes, we need derivatives of all of these quantities with respect to many of the other quantities, first derivatives and second derivatives in some cases. And that's a mess. it's a hard problem. Mathematically, it's an easy problem. It's four differential equations, four ordinary differential equations with a small inhomogeneous term right here, which is the entropy change as a function of time that's caused by chemical composition changes through nuclear burning. So if you ignore that little term there, this is stuff we learned in kindergarten. If you throw that term in, it becomes stuff that we still never have quite understood. And the basic equations mean that we need some basic physics to go in there. We need the equation of state, some measure of the density, chemical composition, and entropy as a function of pressure, temperature, and composition. We need to know something about energy generation. That's another place where some interesting physics comes in. We also need to know about heat flow, where things like atomic physics and hydrodynamics come in. So, how are we doing on this input physics? In some cases, the input physics is relatively easy. You can put in lots of easy approximations to these things and come out with a model that looks something like a star. But then if you want to make that look something like a real star, you have to do some harder physics. So for the equation of state, the easy version is something like the perfect gas, some measure of the mixed ionization state, the Saha equation. There are complications. Matter becomes degenerate high densities. There are interactions between particles which don't fit into the perfect gas mantra, so couplings and so on. For nuclear reaction rates, there's an easy version where you assume the cross-section is described by the cross-section at zero energy, but then again you need to measure cross-sections at higher energy to extrapolate down to low energies, and that can be fraught with difficulties. There are hidden low energy resonances and so on. And then there are additional complications that stars produce other things through nuclear processes, things like neutrinos. Radiative transport for heat flow by radiation. The easy version is a Cramer's opacity. You can look up the formula in Schwarzschild's book and use it and make reasonable models of stars. But stars are made of real atoms. And real atoms have complicated energy level structure, which are populated in a very non-monatomic way as a function of temperature and density and composition. You got to do that right. Conduction happens as well at higher densities. And those are a little bit harder to deal with. And then finally, convective transport. The easy version is a version that we've all used, the mixing length theory, published in the year I was born, and still working as well. And clearly there are complications. So what of these input physics questions can we address with astroseismology, with stellar structure and measuring effective temperatures and gravities and looking at HR diagrams? You can go pretty far to constraining the physics, but in order to constrain the physics at a really high level, you can appeal to astroseismology. And I've highlighted in blue some examples, and you can see they're heavily biased examples of how astroseismology has influenced our understanding of real physics. In terms of the equation of state, Coulomb crystallization, we've actually seen the crystalline interior of some white dwarfs through their pulsations. There are difficult cross-sections. In particular, everybody's favorite difficult cross-section is C12 alpha gamma. And by looking at composition profiles inside white dwarfs, we can constrain that reaction. I'll talk just briefly about that. Neutrino emission, the same deal. In white dwarfs, neutrino emission can be the dominant coolant. And by measuring the change in pulsation periods, we can put limits on the cooling of white dwarfs, where neutrino emission is the dominant cooling mechanism. Radiative transport issues can be addressed by looking at things like the opacity itself and its influence on Cepheid mass determinations, as well as driving in Cepheids and B stars and SDB stars and so on. I'll talk briefly about these, and we'll hear lots more about this from the people actually doing that later in the conference. And then finally, the convective flux, which every time I talk about this sort of thing, I always run out of time magically and don't actually have to talk about. So that probably will happen again today, if I'm lucky. Then there are other issues that are not coefficient related. All of those things relate to the coefficients that appear in our structure equations. There are other issues that are important to know if you want to compute models of stars and compare them with observations. Up there, you need to figure out a way to handle composition changes through nuclear burning. That's a fairly straightforward computational technique. But then there are other things, like diffusion, the fact that heavy elements like to sink, light elements tend to float up, but sometimes heavy elements float up, and that's hard to calculate. We can address at least some of the compositional mixing phenomena with astroseismology. We can look for the depths of convection zones. We can measure composition gradients. We can hopefully see the boundary of convective regions that have been enlarged by convective overshoot, all through astroseismology. Hopefully we can constrain the fiction of semiconvection that way as well, and certainly rotational mixing plays a role in surface abundances that we see and possible important role in affecting interior dynamics that we can also probe with astroseismology. Mass loss and accretion needs to be handled. Mass loss in particular on the giant branch and the production of stars like white dwarf stars. Rotation, magnetic fields, and tidal interactions are also useful to know about in stars, and all can be constrained today with astroseismology, or at least this week. So let's start with the equation of state and talk a bit about that. Things get interesting when you go beyond the perfect gas, that is trouble in paradise or trouble in perfect land when the particles interact. And I don't expect you to memorize any of this thing because I want to concentrate on crystallization. At sufficiently high densities, even in an ionized plasma, you can crystallize by mutual repulsion of the nuclei in the sea of electrons, fighting against gravity. So gravity tries to squeeze them down, but mutual repulsion, a non-ideal effect, can lock that material into a crystalline structure. And that happens when this parameter here is something like 175 or so. So fairly high densities, fairly low temperatures. If that happens, you can crystallize. The temperature of crystallization is measured in units of millions to tens of millions of degrees, and that's effectively the core temperature of a white dwarf star that's sufficiently dense, sufficiently cool, that the interior can crystallize. This parameter, 175 is a good estimate. If you look in the rho T diagram as to where that might happen, it's right around here. So this is a plot from Bill Paxton's MESA tome showing the interiors of a one solar mass main sequence star, a 0.8 solar mass white dwarf, and a star that really could be called Jupiter. And if you look at the track on the temperature density diagram of a white dwarf star, you find that the interior, the relatively hot but certainly high density interior, crosses that threshold of gamma equals 1.75 in the interior, suggesting that the interiors of massive cool white dwarfs, at least, might be crystalline. There are other non-ideal effects in this plane. I won't be talking about any of those, but clearly, if you can measure the interior structure of a white dwarf or other evolved star, you can start to place important constraints on parts of the equation of state that are fairly difficult to calculate and certainly difficult to measure in the lab. So let's talk about crystalline white dwarfs. And I'm going to embarrass Travis by showing something that he produced a few years ago when we investigated one of these stars. Okay, it's done. So again, at sufficient pressure, fully ionized gases can crystallize, forming a crystalline lattice that condensed matter physicists are comfortable dealing with. This again occurs only in massive white dwarfs that are sufficiently cool. If they're massive enough, though cool, they're warm enough to be in something we call the DAV or ZZ-SETI instability strip, which means at least the surface layer should undergo non-radial pulsations. If you have a rock in the middle, a solid in the middle as opposed to a liquid or a gas, then the oscillation modes will behave very differently at that interface than they would if that interior was not there. And so the eigenfunctions change, the eigenfrequency pattern changes for non-radial oscillations depending on whether or not you have a solid crystalline core. And by the way, Travis and the others that worked on this particular object were anticipated in history by about 200 years by the nursery rhyme that we're all familiar with, like a diamond in the sky. Remember, it's carbon and oxygen, an impure diamond. So what Mike Montgomery did with Don Winget many years ago is he looked at the position of BPM 37093 in the effective temperature mass plane and figured out for various masses what the crystallization fraction should be in these stars, and found that for most DA white dwarf pulsators around 0.6 solar masses, crystallization hadn't occurred yet. But in the more massive ones, in particular BPM 37093, the interior was up to 90% crystalline, which means that if we can measure the oscillations and measure them precisely enough to come up with a seismic model, that seismic model's period spacing should reflect the fact that it was mostly crystalline. And a bunch of models were made, and then observations ensued in the usual give and take. And we ended up observing BPM 37093 several times with something called the Whole Earth Telescope, measured the oscillation spectrum, and I have 5 minutes left, and I'm about one-third of the way through. So does that include the 2 minutes you owe me?
No.
Okay, good. So I have 7 minutes left. Anyhow, the models that best fit this thing had a crystalline core of about 90%, suggesting at least, and again, Mike Montgomery yelled at me by email overnight, saying that though these results look really good, everything should be considered preliminary. So a preliminary result is that indeed this star is crystalline, and preliminary is good enough for the Times of London to have a lot of fun with this star. So that's one example of oscillations, stellar oscillations, confirming a rather crazy theory developed by condensed matter physicists and Ed Salpeter in the 1960s. Nuclear processes. Let's stick with the white dwarfs again and see if we can't constrain some difficult cross-sections using seismology. And again, I appeal to the work of Travis and Mike in this regard, looking at this reaction, the C12 alpha-gamma reaction, which is a difficult reaction to extrapolate from observational data or experimental data to the astrophysical domain. Some might argue there's still a factor of 2 to 3 uncertainty in this reaction. This is the ratio of the cross-section to our favorite value, and you can see the numbers are 2 or 3 depending on who's doing the calculation and what it looks like. It's a fairly large uncertainty. And you might think, well, C12 alpha gamma, who cares? I do. This is from Everett Lippmann, a physics of biological systems person who turned into that from astrophysics. And if you look at our composition, we're mostly carbon and oxygen. It would be really nice to know what fraction of carbon and oxygen came to us from evolved stars versus supernova remnants. And the C12 alpha gamma reaction is responsible for the balance of C to O in our universe, depending on the site that it's produced. And those of you that study cosmology and Big Bang nucleosynthesis, you're welcome to my foot. So clearly, this is a fairly important reaction. How can we probe it with astroseismology? Well, we look at the insides of white dwarf stars, which have undergone helium core burning. Here's a movie from John Latanzio that shows evolution through core helium burning to helium exhaustion, and you see the C12 to O16 ratio depends fairly sensitively on the structure of the star depends fairly sensitively on the C12 alpha gamma O16 reaction, because that sets the ratio in the core of something to be a white dwarf star. So you can parameterize that profile as you'd like, and depending on what value of the cross-section you use, you can end up with a lot of oxygen or not too much oxygen, with a gradient that changes as a result. Find a DB white dwarf and measure its core oxygen or carbon abundance, or at least the gradient outside of that core, with astroseismology. And you can, you forgot to put the 5 minute up again because of the 2 minutes. Anyhow, through astroseismology of white dwarfs, at least it's conceivable that we can measure the C12 alpha gamma reaction. And in fact, Travis, way back in the O's, the 2000 O's, was able to show that indeed the NACR reaction rate seems pretty close to what you need to explain the composition of the interiors of white dwarf stars. Okay, in my remaining 20 minutes, I think I'll skip neutrino emission, as exciting as that is, and simply say that since neutrino emission dominates the cooling of white dwarf stars down to about 30,000 Kelvin, if you could measure the rate of period change and confirm that that's a reflection of the evolution rate of the white dwarf stars, then you could say that yes, you're using the correct neutrino rates or not. You do that by the same way pulsar people do, by measuring the advance or retarding of the phase of the oscillation over many years, assuming you've got a stable pulsator. I got rid of that. This has been successful in a few white dwarf stars, and hopefully it will be successful in this particular star, EC2058, where it seems to be very well behaved for the last decade or more. And Dennis Sullivan, in a very slow and plodding way, which is the only way to do this kind of science, is hoping to measure the rate of period change of at least one and probably several modes in this star to see if it's cooling at the rate predicted based on neutrino calculations. And this is just to emphasize that the improvement in the measurement increases as time squared goes by. Okay. Should I skip Cepheids? Pavel, you're here.
Thank you.
You're going to talk about Cepheids a little bit?
No.
Oh, okay. Then I'll go very quickly through Cepheids. Cepheids are, at least the structure and pulsation of cepheids, depends strongly on the composition, or rather the opacity, in the outer regions, in particular where the iron bump is. And calculating the opacity there is difficult. Fortunately, the OPAL folks, Forrest Rogers and Carlos Iglesias, redid those calculations so we didn't have to use the Los Alamos grid, which was every decade in density and temperature. Or no, it's every decade in density and three per decade in temperature. A lot finer grid, a lot better physics. And what that calculation was able to do was solve a long-standing problem, at least partially, on the mass of Cepheids. If you look at the ratio of the first overtone to the fundamental of Cepheid pulsations, you find that that's fairly sensitive to mass. But if you calculate those masses, they differ remarkably from the masses that you expect from evolution. That is, they're much too low. When you use the new opacities, which were required for these things, and Norman Simon pointed out were required for these things before the new calculations were done, a wonderful predictive piece of science that I'm skipping over, what you find is that with that improvement to the opacities that occurred in the early 1990s, Cepheid masses worked out just fine. Okay, I'm halfway done. So I do want to draw attention to talks by Haile Hu and Stefan Charpennet coming up this week, which describe how non-adiabatic pulsations, particularly in the SDB stars, have been a very sensitive probe of radiative levitation of iron in compact stars. And I had a lot on that, but Stefan is here, has been here through the whole program. It's been a lot of fun interacting with him and Haile. And you'll hear from them over the course of the week on the beautiful example of how radiative levitation plus non-adiabatic pulsation calculations have been able to push our understanding of diffusive processes in stars. Very rich subject. And you can sort of see it there. Now, Jorn is standing up. And so I will cut to the chase. Go ahead, cover that. I guess you can turn that off. So here's the chase. Again, reminding you that input physics questions in stars, we can't leave that all to the physicists. It's too important. Physicists can make certain measurements in the labs, but there are certain things that only the theorists can tell us, and we should all be skeptical of theorists, especially when they're keeping time for talks. And here again is a reminder of some of that physics that we can probe. Here again is a reminder of the kinds of things that you'll be telling us over the course of the week that we can do not just for coefficients, but also for circumstances beyond our control. And that is how convection works in stars, how rotational mixing works in stars, and so on. All probable through astroseismology, as we will see. And I will skip Bert's thesis and just leave you with the reminder that we're still talking about spherical cows, and it's the 21st century. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. You had an impossible task, and we can talk about the extra 2 minutes I gave you and the prize for that after the session. So let's start the discussion. Questions? Comments? Yeah? Reiner?
What did you mean to say about the convection
of Not much. As you saw, it was the last thing. Mike Montgomery, Mike, are you here yet? Ah, there he is. Talk to Mike. Hopefully Mike will tell us a little bit about this in his 20 minutes down the line. But yes, you can constrain the model for convection in white dwarfs fairly tightly by looking at pulse shapes and how that the modulation of flux through the photosphere over the course of the pulsation cycle is very sensitive to certain parameters of convection theory.
Yeah, Pavel? Sorry.
Just a short comment that the metal bump, which was calculated by OPAL people and then independently by OP, Mike Seaton, not only solved the problem of mass of period ratios in cepheids, but it solved another long-standing mystery, the driving of beta cepheid stars, which were not driven before, no matter what you did, and with metal bump, they are driven naturally.
And that was on one of my transparencies that went by really fast, but you're absolutely right. It solved a lot of problems. Most of the way, anyway.
Since you are so biased to a compact style, I just wanted to make a statement about the non-ideal effects in equation of state. A poor, humble solar type oscillation can probe that.
Mm.
Well, all right.
So Toby?
About the crystallization in white dwarfs. How well understood is that phase transition? Is it a first order phase transition or a continuous transition? And does that matter from the point of view of seismology?
What's more at issue is whether, since you've got a mixture,
okay, sure.
It's a multi-phase problem. So you've got carbon and oxygen initially mixed. Does the oxygen, which wants to crystallize out first, settle to the center, and then the oxygen form a shell over there? Does it alloy? Those are the kinds of issues that really need to be addressed from a theoretical standpoint that we can do at least somewhat in the astroseismology side. And now the expert will speak. Mike.
Mike.
Yeah, thanks. There's actually been a lot of recent work. We did observational work on a globular cluster 6397 where we see evidence of actual energy release due to a bump in the luminosity function, stars slowing down as they crystallize. And we found that, now of course I never 100% trust the models, but we found that only happened at the right temperature if we assume pure carbon models. Now we didn't believe that. We thought they were carbon oxygen, but that happened at too high a temperature. That prompted these guys, Horowitz and Brown, to go do molecular dynamic simulations of carbon oxygen mixtures. And the mixtures do not crystallize with the same gamma as a pure substance. So the theory of pure substances is perfect. The experiments work. You start adding a mixture, it's like you're adding salt to water. The crystallization temperature goes down. And that's been demonstrated theoretically and observationally now. So I'm really, really excited about that.
So who's next? This is really pretty awful. Oh, Mark. Yes, sir.
Just one quick comment on your spherical cow. Actually, the hydrostatic balance is an incredibly powerful thing, and one-dimensional models have worked so well for stars because there's actually a pretty good physical basis for that.
Right. Anything else? Then let me just add a comment, if I may, as a chairman. That's on the Cepheid instability and the opacity change that Norman Simon suggested. Jørgen Larsen-Petersen in Copenhagen Institute naturally did the inverse problem and predicted the kind of opacity change that was needed to get the right masses of submerged Cepheids. And that actually matches pretty well with what came out of the Livermore opacity calculations. Pardon?
That was Petersen or Andersen?
Petersen and Andersen, yes. And Andreasen. Petersen and Andreasen. Or Petersen and Andreasen. But, so we actually can do physics inversion in astroseismology. We need more of that. So thanks again, Steve. That was great.
Thank you.
So two more practical points that I forgot. First of all, we are going to ask speakers to use their own laptops mainly, because then the talks work, mainly. And secondly, this clock is about 5 minutes fast. So I'll alternate between clocks depending on whether I find the talk boring or not. But just beware when you look at the clock. We are actually on time now. So the next talk is by Travis Metcalf. And since I haven't revised my schedule, he is talking about seismic modeling of solar-like stars. So Travis, thank you.